the philosophes called for artistic freedom, Rousseau for limits. In his essay Letter to D'Alembert, Rousseau argues that the theater perverts truth by fostering illusion. It encourages luxury at the expense of simplicity and frugality. It sets up wit and sophistication as superior to ingenuous and natural values. Since it debases the character of the people, no argument for the pleasure it gives or the good taste it cultivates can carry any weight, for nothing is more important than the people's character. Once that is debased, the state decays and dies. In the letter to D'Alembert, Rousseau also passionately defends traditional sexual morality. Considering that he lived for decades in a common law marriage, this might strike some as hypocritical. But remember, although he attacked the theater, Rousseau was the author of several successful stage productions, so his hypocrisy, if that's what it was, ran rather deep. The next few years were the most productive of Rousseau's life. In quick succession, he wrote and published Julie, or The New Heloise, a novel dealing with the kind of romantic and sentimental themes for which he had harshly censured other playwrights, and Emile, his influential and fictional treatise on education. Most importantly, Rousseau wrote and published his political masterpiece, The Social Contract. The Social Contract is subtitled Principles of Political Right. On the title page, Rousseau identifies himself as citizen of Geneva. And in the brief introduction, Rousseau somewhat smugly underscores the distinction he enjoyed over other philosophes. He was born the citizen of a free state and a member of its sovereign body.
And whenever I reflect upon governments, I am happy to find that my studies always give me fresh reasons for admiring that of my own country.
The less than enthusiastic reception Geneva gave his most famous political work left Rousseau embarrassed and chagrined. Rousseau and Social Contract have been frequently misunderstood, even in the famous lines that open the first chapter.
Man was born free, and he is everywhere in chains. Those who think themselves the masters of others are indeed greater slaves than they. How did this transformation come about? I do not know. How can it be made legitimate? That question I believe I can answer.
Rousseau does not say that he condemns the fact that man is everywhere in chains, but rather that he intends to legitimize it. Human beings began in the state of nature described in First Discourse in isolation. Now they exist in society, dependent on each other and subject to law. Must man accept this change as a brute fact, or can laws and social dependence be made reasonable and just? To answer these questions, Rousseau first considers alternative views on the genesis of legitimate authority. He rejects the notion that government evolves from the father's authority in the family. After all, children outgrow paternal authority. He also ridicules an idea spread by some apologists for absolute monarchy, namely, that legitimate authority descends from the patriarchs of the Bible to the present rulers. Neither can strength be a basis for legitimate authority, since force cannot bind the will of the people. Only consent can. Thus we come to what Rousseau calls the social pact. This concept is key to understanding the social contract. A point is reached in the state of nature where the dangers and difficulties of life make self-preservation tenuous. In order to survive, men combine forces. But how to do that without becoming dependent on other men?
How to find a form of association which will defend the person and goods of each member with the collective force of all, and under which each individual, while uniting himself with the others, obeys no one but himself, and remains as free as before.
The solution lies in the contract which constitutes civil society. Here is one of the most hotly contested passages in all of Rousseau. Here is the essence of this association in Rousseau's social contract.
The total alienation by each associate of himself and all his rights to the whole community. Since the alienation is unconditional, the union is as perfect as it could be, and no individual associate has any longer any rights to claim. If we eliminate from the social pact everything that is not essential to it, we find it comes down to this. Each one of us puts into the community his person and all his powers under the supreme direction of the general will. And as a body, we incorporate every member as an indivisible part of the whole. This act of association creates an artificial and collective body composed of as many members as there are voters in the assembly. And by this same act, that body acquires its unity, its common ego, its life, and its will. In its passive role, it is called the state. When it plays an active role, it is the sovereign.
To many, the total alienation, or surrender of rights to the community, has seemed highly significant and alarming. This contrasts sharply with the classical liberal doctrines of John Locke. In his second treatise on civil government, Locke claims that the rights surrendered to the community are solely those which enable the community to better protect individual rights to life, liberty, and property. Government is an agency of defense for these specific retained rights. Locke's position became standard in British classical liberalism, and it underlies the American Declaration of Independence. In contrast, Rousseau maintains that through the social contract, members of society alienate all rights. Those who contend Rousseau is not a promoter of liberty in any commonly understood sense, but rather that he is the father of modern totalitarianism, point to this alienation of rights. Others, who side with Rousseau, point to his reasons for supposing the social contract will not be and cannot be oppressive. For one thing, the conditions of the contract are the same for all. Thus, no one can have an interest in making conditions onerous for others. Rousseau explains another safeguard of liberty within the social contract.
Since each man gives himself to all, he gives himself to no one. And since there is no associate over whom he does not gain the same rights as others gain over him, each man recovers the equivalent of everything he loses, and in the bargain, he acquires more power to preserve what he has.
Exactly what the individual preserves if he alienates everything is difficult to say. This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and begin Side 2.